question I'd like us to engage today in our time of reflection is, what form does Herod take in our lives, in the life of our church, in the life of our world today? And there may be many Herods, and we're going to explore something about what stands in opposition to our ability to draw close to God and to be faithful in the things God has called us to do and to be. Locating ourselves in this story is an important one, and to begin that, I wanted to remind you, or perhaps let some of you know, of a particular book whose interesting plot line and storyline, I think, has something to say to us even today and to our human condition. In 1991, Stephen King wrote a book called Needful Things. Some of you may have read that or remember that. It was made into a movie in 1993. Not a very good rendition, I felt, of the book, but that be that as it may, with Max von Sydow and Ed Harris. But the book has to do with this. It is set in a fictional town, Castle Rock, Maine, in New England. And into that town has come what seems like a goodly, kindly old man who opens up a store. Needful Things, called Leland Gaunt. And in that store can be found among the inventory something that everyone in that town most desires. Now, for David Rusk, it is an autographed copy of a Sandy Koufax baseball card that has his own name on it. For Buster, it is a little machine that simulates horse racing so that he could use it to predict and win bets at the horse track. For Alma, it has to do with a little necklace that will relieve her of her arthritis. The trick is this. In the store, none of the residents can afford what they most desire. And so Leland has invited them into a way to get what they most desire. And all they have to do is to do a little favor for him. And that favor is to play a trick, to do something a little bit naughty against someone in the town. And they do that and they can come and get this prize gift. Well, as the book unfolds, slowly things lead to things and the whole community ends up in chaos, even murder. And the only one able to resist this is the town sheriff, who is trying to get to the bottom of it. But everyone, in the pursuit of what they most desire, are willing to compromise integrity, even friendships or relationships, to do what they have to get what they want. It's an interesting book with a very ingenious plot line. As it turns out, Leland is actually the devil incarnate, whose store Needful Things everybody ignores. The little sign over the store that says, caveat emptor, buyer beware. And as the story ends and he's driven out of the town, it opens up as he takes up residence in another town. And this time his sign reads, answered prayers. I think that that story is an invitation to us. What is it that we most desire? What are we willing to do to get what we most desire? To what or to whom will we bow down to get our heart's wishes? And this story that we read today from Matthew is one that invites us to ponder that as we read what looks like a very quaint depiction that we see at many manger scenes and nativity depictions and so forth. But it is an invitation to probe deeper, deeper into our own lives, our life as a community of faith, and even our world. It seems like the primary character of this particular text is Herod. Five times Herod's name is mentioned. And we have to give, as it were, Herod his due. In other words, talk about the prominence of Herod and the work of Herod. But you see, this Herod wasn't the only Herod. But 40 years before the birth of Jesus, this Herod came to power, was given the title Herod the Great, King of the Jews. And after consolidating his power and authority in all Judea, he decided that he was going to be the chief boss. Everything had to go through him. Herod the Great. This is the Herod that we read of here. But you see, in the Bible, there are actually five Herods in the New Testament. This Herod, as you see, tries to kill Jesus. His son, who after he dies, is the period when Jesus returns and stays away from Archelaus, also is Herod, but he didn't last very long, was deposed. And then his next son, the third Herod, came to power. Now that is the Herod that persecuted John the Baptist and chopped off his head and also stood in judgment over Jesus. But then there was the grandson of Herod the Great who came after, who persecuted Peter and martyred James. And yet there was a fifth Herod who contended with Paul, claiming he tried to convert him and persecuted. Every Herod that is described in the New Testament had to do with undermining the purposes of God, trying to destroy what Jesus was up to and those who would follow him. So Herod becomes a symbol for opposition to that which God is trying to unveil and to break open into the world. That symbol obtains today, I believe. What is the Herod in your life or my life? Or in the life of our community, the life of our city, the life of our world, that is seeking to undermine the purposes of God, to bring light, to bring welcome, to bring grace, to bring hope, to bring love. For those questions begin to come close to the bone when we realize that sometimes it is the church that acts like Herod. Yesterday at In From the Cold had a very interesting conversation with one of our guests. I liked this fellow. He was very challenging. Told me all kinds of things he disagreed about the church. Told me, I wouldn't want your job for all the money in the world. I said, well, thank you. But he said, because the church is divided and fights against itself, and sometimes it's the very church that does the things that God doesn't want it to do. And I nodded and agreed, and he was surprised that I agreed with him. And he gave examples of how he had visited different churches, and because he doesn't fit the norm, he doesn't maybe dress the way or think the same way or raises questions, is radical in his approach, that he's not accepted by the prim and proper people, and they're always trying to get rid of him. I told him he'd be welcomed here. He said he'd give it some thought. Sometimes Herods are found in a community of faith as representations of those that are seeking to undermine what God is trying to do. In order to fully engage this, let's look at the story in a deeper way. We have a very quaint way of understanding the role of the wise ones, but nobody really knows who these wise ones were. Tradition and legend has it that they were kings from the east. There are some, like Herodotus in the fifth century, who talks about them as kind of like magicians, as it were. They belonged to a caste of people, maybe in the royal court, yes, in Persia, but would have been tantamount to those that we might consider astrologers or even quacks today. There are others that believe they might have been Kurds, ancient Kurds. Nobody knows for sure. And contrary to the popular notion that there were three of them, Matthew never says there were three. The number three actually comes from the gifts, three types of gifts. But there could have been many more. To add to the drama and the mystique, Queen Helena decided, she had a vision, And in this vision, she was led to the place where these three kings, who had by this time had been given names, Melchor, Gaspar, and what's the other one? Belteshazzar, that's right. Thank you. See, we need a community to get these things right. But Queen Helena had this dream, and she was led to the place and exhumed these bodies and took the skulls, and even to this day, they're on display in Cologne, Germany. It's all this mystique and so forth, but I think it misses the point. Because what Matthew is trying to do in his story is to shock the readers and to shock us even today as contemporary engagers of this story. You see, the Old Testament scriptures talk about diviners, or those who would sell their wares as divining the future or what was going on, as those to stay away from. Just before the time of Christ, there was a rabbi who wrote that anyone who receives wisdom from a magi is worthy of death. So the magoi, or the magi, were suspicious people. They are scandalous if you think about the role that Matthew gives them in this story. Remember, Matthew, of all the Gospels, has a particular audience in mind, the Jewish people. He uses the most quotations from Hebrew Scripture. And his point in this particular story, I believe, is to invite a radical understanding of what God has done in Jesus. You see, Epiphany, this Sunday that we celebrate this particular story, sometimes we say it's manifestation or unveiling, and that is true. But literally from the Greek, it means fantasy from outside. Epi, exterior, phantasmos, fantasy from outside. There's something absolutely fantastic, crazy, that has come from outside to us. What is this crazy thing? What is the unveiling that is to take place? Well, as we read, Herod is in opposition, trying to stop worship and witness. And these magi are invited to shock us into a new understanding. Imagine this for a moment. They are not to be included in polite company, according to the Jewish mindset. These are foreigners, outsiders, and they begin to tell us, as we realize that God welcomes the worship of those whom we think don't matter or count or shouldn't be here. For they are the ones who kneel at the manger. They are the ones who bring their gifts. They are the ones who discern that somehow God has led them to a place where if they went through the regular venue, and channels might not have reached. You know what is interesting? They come to Jerusalem, and Herod is smart enough to realize that there's nothing special going on there. And he calls his chief priests and his theologians together and asks them, where are we going to find this birth? And they find this book, this verse from Micah 5, that talks about Bethlehem being the place. And he tells them. He tells them to go to Bethlehem, find out what they can, and come back and report so that he could go and worship. Is that true? Did Herod have any intention of going to worship the Christ child? None at all. None at all. And what I believe that Matthew is saying, this isn't the first scandal that we find in Matthew's book, is that despite the work of Herods, of all shapes, of all sizes, of all denominations, of all political stripes, of all do-gooders, of all shapes and sizes, despite the Herod's worship and witness to this radical God, who in Jesus begins to demonstrate that all who thought they were outside the pall of acceptance are reached out to by grace. And their worship is celebrated. Now, I was trying to think of an example for our day today, because we don't have the same emotional reaction to the Magi that the original hearers of this story would have. They would have been shocked and scandalized by this story. So suppose at our nativity scenes, in addition to Mary and Joseph and the baby and the shepherds and the wise ones, suppose we had a depiction there of oh, I don't know, Osama bin Laden. Suppose we had a depiction there of, and each of you fill in for yourself, some relative or person that you think could not in God's good earth have any favor from God at all. Right there, smack in the middle of the nativity scene. Just suppose. Then you begin to get the idea of what Matthew has done to the people who read this. For it's not just about the in-group anymore, but Matthew is saying, despite every form of Herod that may take shape, God is going to break through and in this Christ child radicalize our notions about who's in and who's out. It is the promise given to Abraham and Sarah that through you all the nations shall be blessed. Here it is coming to pass. All the nations, people from everywhere, scandalous, scoundrels, whomever, they're coming to offer worship to Jesus. Make room in your prejudice. Make room in your attitude. Make room in your heart for everybody that God brings to worship the Christ child. That's the scandal of the story. Make room. Because God welcomes all to come and worship. And the community of faith, us here, have to struggle with what it means to participate with God in the welcome of those we would rather not associate with, whose worship, as we see, God welcomes. So Herod's, do your worst. You cannot stop the worship of God. You cannot stop the witness to the one who in this Christ child foretells something to come. This is the same Christ child who, when he grew, welcomed the outcasts, touched the lepers, had a word of redeeming love and forgiveness for adulterers, for greasy, on-the-take, under-the-table kind of economy toll collectors, for the rich who were challenged by their wealth. This is the same Christ who scandalized people at every year of his life with the startling news of God's welcome. And all shall live forevermore because of Christmas Day. This Christ child has implications for all the world. So, let's return to where we began. What is it that you and I, what is it that we as a community of faith are willing to exchange, are willing to do for that which we most desire? Could it be that this story is inviting us to desire what God desires, that all will find a place, kneeling, submitting, offering worship to the Christ, whose vision, mission, and program for the world is one of redemption and justice and salvation and healing and joy. Because if we, like the wise ones, can for a moment experience what it means to discover that, then this little line in the text will be our privilege to experience. The text says, and when they found the child, they rejoiced with an exceeding joy. The Greek there is a very interesting one. It just doubles over on itself. It falls over itself with accolades. In other words, they were joyous beyond joy, and then joyous on top of that. Don't you want that joy? I do. I do. I don't know how close I am to it yet, because there are still barriers, still prejudices, still things that don't allow me to fully participate in the radical grace of God. And what this Christ means to the whole world. When I can do that, I will know what the wise ones felt. Joy upon joy and joy on top of that.